about some issues that don't look like they have anything to do with cosmology. And yet, you'll see that it was because of trying to understand the cosmological constant problem initially that led me into this whole question. But the issues that I'll present today go way beyond cosmology and are interesting, even if the application that I'll try to give at the end to cosmology turns out to be wrong. So you'll still be able to go home with something. And that is, the Hamiltonians don't ever need to be diagonalized. There are various approaches to quantum gravity. The going one is string theory. The second going one is loop quantum gravity. And then there are people working on ADS-CFT. What I want to do is I want to describe what in the end is the most mundane and down-to-earth approach to quantum gravity, namely, start off with a theory of gravity which is renormalizable. And rather than introduce Newton's constant as a fundamental constant, because then you have a non-renormalizable theory, and you have to go to rather, in my opinion, extreme extents in order to try to make sense of that as a quantum theory. So I'm going to say, let's consider the possibility that gravity be renormalizable. Now, there is a bona fide renormalizable quantum gravity theory, which I'll introduce very quickly. And it's called conformal gravity. And conformal gravity is simply, I guess in Canada one uses a hockey stick. You make this transformation, g mu mu goes to e to the 2 alpha of x. You demand local conformal invariance, where alpha changes from point to point. And it leads you to a unique theory. The action has to be the contraction of the vial tensor with itself. And c has 2 derivatives, 4 derivatives, d4x, makes the coupling constant dimensionless. So this is the example of a dimensionless coupling constant, and it is indeed power counting renormalizable. Moreover, if you write the equations of motion, the equations of motion are fourth order, but they involve the vial tensor, and the vial tensor happens to vanish in a Robertson-Walker geometry, namely in cosmology. Therefore, the vial tensor vanishes, which means the total energy momentum tensor of the universe is zero, which means that the cosmological constant is zero. It also means that, unlike standard gravity, you know exactly where the zero of energy is. And in fact, the cosmological constant problem, is there some chalk here? Yeah. Do we need Microsoft permission for that?
Thank you.
And the problem of the cosmological constant for the standard theory is you introduce this double well potential, and this is the cosmological constant. It's the difference between the energy of the local maximum and the local minimum. But you can move this potential up and down, and you'll never know where the zero is. And it's not knowing where the zero is which creates the cosmological constant problem in the standard theory. In this theory, you do know where the zero is. But you pay a price. The price that you pay is that this equation of motion is fourth order. And fourth order equations of motion are thought to contain ghosts, to lead you to states of negative norm, and to not lead you to a unitary quantum theory. To show you if I take this theory and I linearize it around flat space time, then I can cast it as this action. It's a quartic action where phi would be any component of the metric. I've introduced an m squared for the moment, and we'll see that this is very dangerous. But I write down the equation of motion for this is for the free fluctuations around the free conformal gravity vacuum. The propagator goes like 1 over k squared minus m squared. You can write this as partial fractions, 1 over n squared, 1 over k squared minus m squared times minus 1 over k squared, and you see here the minus sign. Now,
so this is m squared, is that supposed to be an analog of a Ricci tensor term in the gravity case?
This would be conformal gravity plus standard gravity. Yeah, that would give me the second order. You'll see why I'm doing that in a moment. This is actually second plus fourth, but you'll see why. Now, if you look at this propagator, asymptotically it behaves like 1 over k to the 4. 1 over k to the 4 makes gravity renormalizable. What used to be a quadratic divergence now becomes a logarithmic divergence. However, the way that you do it is you have a regular graviton and a graviton with a negative metric sign. And so these two cancel each other's short distance problems, and that's how you solve the theory far off the mass shell. But the question is, are you going to get buried? Does this minus sign translate into a loss of unitarity on shell? What that would mean is, if you just naively wrote the propagator in terms of a basis of waves, you would say that this term corresponds to a completeness relationship of that form. This term corresponds to a second completeness relationship with a relative minus sign, and then you will find that the S matrix is not neutral. The purpose of this talk is to tell you that the line of reasoning from there to there is simply wrong. You can't look at the propagator, which is a C number, and tell you what the Hilbert space of the quantum theory will look like until you construct the quantum theory. So what we will have to do is construct the Hilbert space first. Now, you also notice that this decomposition fails when m squared goes to 0, because this term blows up, and that just becomes 1 over k to the 4. So the statement that is actually in the literature is that second plus fourth has a ghost and is not unitary. And there is no statement in the literature regarding pure fourth. We're going to see that both cases, in fact, are completely unitary, but for reasons that are very, very surprising. The literature on this, I've done some work with Carl Bender on the ghost problem in fourth order theories. We have a FizzRed letter, which we lost a lot of weight, a lot of angst in getting published, but it shows you that once in a while, the system can be beaten. And then we had a FizzRed, we were very disappointed, the referee didn't even put up a fight.
Did you have a subdivision editor?
We had two.
Did you have the one that we know about?
No, we had, there's a different bracket, there's a different problem. Anyway, so these papers are published. Carl Bender has been working on something called PT quantum mechanics, where the Hamiltonian is not emission but commutes with the combination P times T. I had been working earlier with Aaron Davidson on the fourth order oscillator, just the quantum mechanics of the theory I just gave you a moment ago. And this is my earlier work and current work. I'll try to get to this at the end of the talk, namely how it all impacts on the cosmological constant problem. Okay, so that's the literature, the recent literature, and now let's look at the issues. There are certain things that we take for granted in quantum mechanics. The Hamiltonian must be Hermitian. The momentum operators must be Hermitian. In the XP equals IH bar commutator, the momentum operator can always be represented by P is minus IH bar B by dx. States such as energy eigenstates must form a complete set. To be complete, states must be normalizable. The scalar product must be given as Mn is delta Mn, and the completeness relation must be given as the sum on Nn is equal to 1. Theories in which Nn, the Dirac scalar product, is negative are unphysical and cannot be formulated in Hilbert space, and the Hamiltonian must be diagonalizable. Believe it or not, all of these things ain't necessarily so. None of them are theorems of nature. Moreover, theories based on fourth order derivatives are necessarily theories where all of these are violated. Every single one. And we're going to uncover a whole new branch of quantum mechanics called PT quantum mechanics. Now,
what does PT stand
for? Parity and time reversal. Yes. I'm sorry. Okay. It's a generational thing. What age you were, you got into physics to know what particular acronyms
are the ones to use.
Now, let's go back and look at this theory very carefully. Look at this wave equation, and I'm going to simplify it. I'm going to drop the spatial dependence by simply taking a plane wave, defining omega 1 and omega 2 to be functions of the momentum and the mass, and the wave equation that I just gave you, that fourth order equation 13, reduces to equation 18. Equation 18 is just the quantum mechanics of a fourth order derivative quantum field theory, can be derived from an action. That action was first written down by Pice and Uhlenbeck in 1950, and this problem has been around for 50 years, making sense of this action. It contains things we know and love, a z squared term, a z dot squared term, but it also contains a z double dot squared term. And now I say to you, forget everything I've said so far. Here's the question. Suppose somebody, one of your grad students, simply says to you in your quantum mechanics class, what would happen if there was an acceleration-dependent term in the Lagrangian? And you would say, nothing much different than before. And it turns out that everything is different. If we introduce an acceleration-dependent term, we can go from the action to the Hamiltonian. Turns out, you have to be careful, because you have a z dot, and a z double dot. You have more degrees of freedom than one-dimensional oscillator, but fewer degrees of freedom than a two-dimensional oscillator. Z dot is simultaneously the canonical conjugate of z and of z double dot, and therefore you solve the problem by introducing a new variable x, and then you can use the method of Dirac constraints. This is what Davidson and I did, and you come up with the action of equation 20, which shows you that the Hamiltonian can be written in terms of two sets of oscillators, x and px, z and pz, which obey canonical commutation relations. We later discovered that this Hamiltonian, or the prescription for getting it, had first been written down by Ostrogrodsky in 1850, and we have been able to confirm that he was correct. This is the only time in my life that I have made a reference to a paper that was not written in the 20th or the 21st century. And I've never read the paper, by the way.
I have.
Ah, well, of course, you're contemporaneous. Yeah, you read it in when it was written. Okay, so. Very good. Anyway, so
who is this man?
Ah, he's a remarkable man. His name is Ostrogrodsky. And in 1850, he asked the question, how do you generalize Hamilton to higher derivative theories? Suppose the Lagrangian is a function of Q, Q dot, Q double dot, and so on. And he gave the complete answer. And this theory, being a higher derivative theory, falls into his case. But also, we derived it using the method of Dirac constraints, which John could have read in grad school.
Yeah, there's a story about him that you have to hear. I can't persist in telling you. He's also famous for another reason. He was a senior member of the St. Petersburg Academy of Science.
Yeah, well, that's where the paper's published.
And there was a paper submitted by Lobachevsky, another Russian, on non-Euclidean geometry. And this gentleman refereed the paper and rejected it and said, this is absolute nonsense.
Yes, and Lobachevsky, I think Lobachevsky then sent it to Gauss. And that's why it's called Gauss-Lobachevsky.
No, he didn't send it. Yeah, you mean Lobachevsky sent it to Gauss for a free.
Yeah.
So there are even problems with peer review in those days.
There we go. Now, suppose I give you this Hamiltonian. It's got a px squared term, an x squared, and a z squared term, but it's also got this funny pzx cross term, and there's no pz squared term. So now we ask, let's just try to diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the normal way. We introduce two sets of oscillators, a and a dagger for one, a and a dagger for two, and then we discover very quickly the Hamiltonian can be diagonalized in this form. It's diagonal a1 dagger minus a2 dagger, but the A1, A1 dagger commutator is positive if omega 1 is greater than omega 2. The A2, A2 dagger commutator is negative. So if you say, I'll take the state that A1 and A2 vanish, you find that that state has energy of the zero point energy of two oscillators, a half omega 1 plus omega 2. Why is it positive? Because there are two minus signs to compensate, but the state A2, A2 dagger has a negative norm. So you will see in the literature the claim that this theory can produce you positive energy states, but the price that you pay is negative energy norm. If you wanted to avoid that, you would let A2 dagger annihilate the vacuum, and if A2 dagger annihilates the vacuum, then the theory becomes unbounded below. So there are two realizations of the theory. One is norms are positive, theory is unbounded below. Other is theory energy is bounded below, but norms are negative. Could that possibly be wrong? Turns out it looks like it's insurmountable, and that's the problem that's been around for 50 years, but quantum mechanics is not a local theory. Quantum mechanics is a global theory. If you want to know anything about the wave function, you have to look at the wave function at infinity. So we take this state, omega 1, we take this state here, and we construct its wave function by just taking the Hamiltonian and using the usual d by dx and d by dc, and we calculate the wave function, and this is the wave function, e to the plus v squared, e to the minus x squared. This state is not normalizable. If the state were normalizable, the theory would be dead, because then you would have states of negative norm, which are normalizable. Now let's go back to our friend over here. When we make this expansion, you're expanding the propagator, which is an example of a function in terms of a complete basis. You are presuming that these psi's are normalizable. If they're not normalizable, that expansion doesn't hold. But this equation still has a solution. The propagator still exists, but cannot be expanded in a naive basis. So we've learned that this one fails, and therefore that one fails, but that just tells us what fails, it doesn't tell us what works. So now we go back, and we go back to this wave function, and we see that if we were to make z pure imaginary, this wave function would be normalizable. It's normalizable on the imaginary z-axis, not on the real z-axis. Now, when I take the commutator of x of z with pz, I can realize it not just with z minus I d by dz, but I can put in an e to the I theta and an e to the minus I theta, and have psi be a function of e to the I theta z. When can I make this representation of the momentum operator? When this is a good test function, when it's square integrable. When you show, to show that an operator's Hermitian, you have to do an integration by parts, and you always throw the surface term away. But you can't if the wave function isn't normalizable. That means that you can't represent the momentum operator as minus id by dz acting on the real axis. You have to represent it as minus id by dz, where z is pure imaginary. Namely, in terms of real numbers, you replace z by minus iz and p by d by dz, and therefore pz and z are not Hermitian, they are anti-Hermitian. So the solution to the problem is the momentum and the position operators of the theory are not Hermitian. They live on the imaginary axis, they don't live on the real axis. Now, why must this be the case? We saw a moment ago that we had a theory with two realizations. One in which the energy is bounded below and the norm is negative, and the other in which the energy, in which the energy is unbounded below and the norm is positive. Well, we can't have two different realizations have the same classical limit. You can only have one classical limit of the theory. So the one where the momentum operators is are Hermitian corresponds to the normal classical limit where the energy is unbounded below. But there's another realization of the theory in which the momentum and the position operators are anti-Hermitian, and they don't have a classical limit. Now, you've seen this all your life, because when you write down the commutator of Jx to Jy is ijz, and you derive it by writing J as r cross p, and you quantize the position and the momentum, you then discover that this also has a second set of representations of spin a half, which had nothing to do with the motion in phase space. So the quantum mechanics has two realizations, only one of which has a classical limit. This theory has a second realization in which the momentum and the position operators are anti-Hermitian, and it has no conventional classical limit. If you want to give it a classical limit, it has a classical limit in which the classical coordinates are pure imaginary. If you really wanted to do that. But you don't need to, because we live in a quantum mechanical world. Yes, of course.
So then why do you say this theory has any relationship with what we started from?
Because I'm going to require that the one that we started from, that the momentum and the position operators were anti-Hermitian. It's a different realization of the original theory.
There's no physical correspondence.
The physical correspondence, let me make a little detour. When you learn classical mechanics, you discover that the classical Poisson brackets, x with p is 1, that the classical Poisson brackets have a set of symplectic transformations in which you make these complex. We never occurred to do that in ordinary classical mechanics, because included in the symplectic class is one in which they are real. So we always use the real one, and that's led us to think that classical mechanics must be defined with real numbers. But classical mechanics has symplectic symmetry. What this is saying is that there are two regions of the theory. This is one class of symplectic transformations, and this is a different class. And those are different classical theories. And this boundary was discovered by Stokes. It's called the Stokes line. And these things are called Stokes wedges. And there are different Stokes lines in classical physics because there are boundaries between classes of symplectic transformations. So from the point of view of classical physics, we could have lived here or here, and those are different theories. They have, when you use Poisson brackets and replace them by commutators, they become different theories. I'm going to show you in a moment. It's the domain in which these operators are Hermitian or anti-Hermitian. You see, the operator P is Hermitian. You can throw away the circuit.
Different reality conditions.
What?
Different reality conditions.
It's
at the classical level.
At the classical level, yes. That's all it is. Now, let me just state this, and I'll state it very, very firmly. We have been brought up to believe the classical physics is based on real numbers. That is nonsense. Classical physics is based on C numbers, namely numbers that commute. Starting from quantum mechanics, if you can take the h bar equals zero limit, you will get a set of C numbers. Nothing requires them to be real. We're just used to them being real because we are always in either in this case or in which the entire complex plane is the same Stokes wedge. But that's a very special case. I'm going to show you some examples of this in a moment. Yes, sir.
Just a question. Classical physics, you could base it on complex numbers, right? But usually there's a notion which is a star structure. There's a reality structure.
It doesn't have to be. That's what I'm saying.
In order to do classical physics, we took a notion of complex conjugate. So there's a notion of star. You know, every operator has a.
But there's an analog statement in the quantum theory. You have to define a different star product.
Not star product. Okay. Star structure.
We'll see.
We usually say that P is the mean. Momenta is the mean.
Yes, we do. What I'm saying is there's nothing in physics that requires that.
I thought the classical variable was a measurable variable.
That's correct.
In the real world.
No. That's
an imaginary world.
No. That's what I'm saying is the classical physics, as derived from quantum physics, is a physics of C numbers. Nothing more.
It's not classical in the sense of a real world.
But that's because that was the one we found first.
The whole business of elasticity was introduced to quantum mechanics by Bohr.
Yeah, I know, but this is out. I'm going to, Robbie, I'm sorry, I don't want to jump ahead. I'm going to give you a whole new branch of quantum mechanics. It's outside of the Bohr framework. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yes.
So there are physical systems that are unstable in some limits somewhere, right? If I do some bomb field somewhere.
Yeah. Okay.
So why wouldn't you accept that some Hamiltonian, some action gives me a system with just some stability and which will be taken care of at higher energies by some other
You can ask the question, if I stayed in the conventional realization where the energy is unbounded below, can I stabilize the theory, maybe by putting in a potential which would then give me a very low bounded state, very low energy, but at least it would be bounded. The answer is yes, you can do that. But quantum mechanics doesn't require you to do that, and what I'm going to show you later on is that the theory I'm working with can only be done that way. We'll try to get there. Yes?
What Robert is asking is, how do I measure the velocity of a particle with a number, a real number?
What you measure in physics are matrix elements of quantum. You measure matrix elements of quantum operators. Now, if you don't want, you're never required that those matrix elements have anything to do with theories in classical physics. You're not required to have an Ehrenfest theorem. If you want an Ehrenfest theorem for this realization, then the wave packet's propagating in the complex plane, if you want to do that. But you never do that for spin a half. You live with quantum mechanical spin a half, and that's all I'm asking you to do. I'm asking you to live with a theory in which the momentum and the position operator are anti-Hermitian. I'm perfectly allowed, that's a completely consistent quantum theory. It may have a funny classical limit, but that's not a law of nature. There is no law of nature which says quantum systems have to have a good classical limit.
No,
and spin a half is the best example.
Okay,
but anyway, let me proceed because life gets more interesting. So now, what I will do, and you cannot object to this, all I'm going to do is take my original theory, and I'm going to make a similarity transformation. Z goes to minus IZ, and Q goes to P goes to IPZ, and introduce new dynamical variables Q and Y, where Q and Y are now non-Hermitian. Q and Y are now Hermitian again. P and X were always Hermitian because I didn't catch them. But the Hamiltonian, and this is the important point, the Hamiltonian has this PZX term, and it's a product now of a Hermitian operator and an anti-Hermitian operator, so I pick up a minus IQX. So this Hamiltonian is no longer Hermitian. So I found a similarity transformation which makes the Hamiltonian not Hermitian. As soon as you see that the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, then you immediately worry, well, maybe the energies are no longer real. Well, the answer to that question is, if a Hamiltonian is Hermitian, the energies are real. But a Hamiltonian doesn't have to be Hermitian to make the energies real. That's an example which I'll be coming back to later on, is the Hamiltonian, the matrix 1101, is not Hermitian and has two eigenvalues, both of which are equal to 1. This is a canonical example, and we'll see in a moment why this is actually relevant. But for the moment, all I want to do is show you that non-Hermitian Hamiltonians can have real eigenvalues. Now, Carl Bender and his friends have been working on this problem for many years. They looked at the Hamiltonian p squared plus ix cubed. They threw it on Mathematica, and all the eigenstates came out real. Mathematical fact, the eigenstates of this theorem, of this Hamiltonian, has been pure, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the energy eigenvalues are all real. They discovered afterwards that the reason was that the theory is PT symmetric, namely under parity x cubed goes to minus x cubed, but under time reversal I goes to minus I. And this Hamiltonian is PT symmetric, And if the Hamiltonian is PT symmetric, then you can take PT on the Hamiltonian acts on the state psi, if the Hamiltonian acts on PT of psi, and if this is an eigenstate, that's PT E psi, and that's E star PT psi, and therefore you can show that if the symmetry is good, that E is equal to E star, and that the energies are real. So the time reversal tends the energy into itself, and so you can have a theory in which the energy eigenvalues are real. Now, it turns out that theories of that type, where the energy spectrum is completely real, admitted the following set of operators. As well as PT, there exists yet another operator called C, like charge conjugation. C commutes with the Hamiltonian, C commutes with PT, C squared is 1, C can be written as E to the Q times P, and for our case here, for our Hamiltonian, you can construct the C operator completely, and the Q is just alpha, a real number, function of the frequencies, times PQ plus XY. So Laurent was asking me yesterday, what does it look like, this Q operator, E to the Q? It looks like this. And now there's a second theorem that these PT people have. Bender said to me, now you've got Q, apply E to the minus Q over 2, H E to the Q over 2, and I guarantee you, you'll get a Hermitian Hamiltonian. I said, you must be joking, but it's a theorem that when you do this, you get a Hermitian Hamiltonian, P squared plus X squared plus Q squared plus Y squared. Now that's a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator, and it is as normal a theory as you've ever seen. So what we've discovered is that the theory that we had initially looks like it's not Hermitian, but it can be brought into a Hermitian, into a manifestly Hermitian form by a similarity transformation. Now,
is this the transformation of the Hamiltonian, which was IX cubed?
Yes, the IQX. No. This is for my theory. For his theory,
to the one which was
they constructed that one as well. Yes.
And it's made Hermitian with one variable, with one degree of freedom.
Yes.
So you don't have to.
That's right. It's linear in P and X. Yes. In fact, ordinarily it's linear in P and X, but because we have two oscillators, this one's quadratic. Yes. And they've actually shown mathematically that it must exist.
So once you do that.
Yes.
The original Bender thing with IX cubed.
Yes.
When you make your symmetry transformation,
yes,
allows a physical interpretation.
Yes, yes, yes. If you want to do it that way, yes, absolutely. You are perfectly free to say that that's what I was saying before. The similarity transformations in the complex theory, in the quantum theory, are the same as symplectic transformations in the classical theory.
Can you give an indication of what that X means?
No, because I've not studied their theory, but Carl, I believe, can, and I think in that huge review he wrote, I believe it's there.
What happened to the states under this?
We're gonna do the states immediately, but what I wanted to show you first was, I believe that you will accept that this Hamiltonian with every body Hermitian is perfectly bounded from below and must be a unitary theory. Therefore, the previous theory must have been unitary. So what's going on? The big deal about Q is that, and this answers what Laurent was asking me yesterday, Q itself is Hermitian because P and Q are Hermitian and they commute. Similarly, X and Y. So Q is Hermitian, but a unitary transformation U is E to the IQ, where I, well, there's an extra I. So this transformation is not unitary. It doesn't preserve norms. It doesn't convert orthogonal into orthogonal. What it's doing is it's taking states at an angle and rotating them into states that are orthogonal. So let's see what's going on. Remember, H tilde is diagonal. So for H tilde, I can define energy eigenstates E. For H, I can define energy eigenstates N, but En is the same because a similarity transformation is isospectral and doesn't change the energies. So the energies are the same, but the states are related by a transformation matrix because it's not a unitary transformation. And then when you construct the left eigenstate of H tilde, that's N tilde, but the left eigenstate of H is N e to the minus Q. So what happens is, for a Hamiltonian that is not Hermitian, if you have a Hamiltonian where you have a right eigenvector and you have R H dagger is equal to R E if E is real, then H dagger acting on R is not H acting on R. The left eigenstate is L H is equal to L E. And so the left eigenstate is not the Dirac conjugate of the right eigenstate. And the completeness relation is therefore the sum on left right is equal to 1, and not the sum on Nn is equal to 1. It's right, I'm sorry, right left. I said it the wrong way. This is the completeness relation. It's the sum on right left is equal to 1. And in the literature, these are called biharmonic. Yes, sir?
Is this just as simple as saying you have an operator with the real spectrum but whose eigenvectors are not orthogonal?
That's correct. The answer is it's as simple as that once you've realized the key step, namely that you have to make the transformation to pure imaginary. Yes. Everything you've said is... look, let me put it this way. The big deal about the theory...
Yes,
the big deal about the theory is that when I first give you the Hamiltonian, wherever it is, when I first give you the Hamiltonian, you immediately think that this is Hermitian. You just say, obviously, it's obviously Hermitian, it's X and P, what else can it be? Only if X and P separately are Hermitian, because unlike a term like X squared, if X was anti-Hermitian, X squared would still be real. But now I have a cross term between two oscillators, and now it's the case that they're separately, one is Hermitian and the other is anti-Hermitian, one second, and that brings me to a Hamiltonian, which is now no longer Hermitian. But fortunately, its energies are real, and therefore, there is another Hamiltonian that is Hermitian that it must be transformable into because its basis was skewed. Yes, sir?
So, does this all boil down to if you have a non-trivial inner product instead of...
Yes, it all boils down to who is the inner product. Yes. Okay. You see, the whole point is that the usual case is that the inner product is taken between the state and its conjugate.
Usually it's just this L squared inner product, but you could put a kernel in inner product.
If you want to do the inner product in coordinate space, then it's L squared on the imaginary axis. These are square integral on the imaginary axis, not on the real axis. Okay. If for an operator to be Hermitian in the conventional sense, you need L squared on the real axis. And that's the case that we've been now using for 80 years. And what we're saying is that's not required by quantum mechanics, it's allowed by quantum mechanics. So what you discover is that if you had a Hermitian Hamiltonian, the left eigenstate would simply be the conjugate of the right eigenstate, and the norm would be the one that we know and love. So everything that we know and love holds for Hermitian operators, but not for non-Hermitian operators. Now let's understand what's the difference between...
Before you go on...
Please, yes.
It is omega 1 minus omega 2. How is that defined?
Oh, okay. It was just in terms of the original... That's going to be very important in a moment. In terms of the original K squared and M squared, omega 1 and M 2 are just the momentum. They become...
So each one is positive?
Yes.
And the relative... omega 1 is always greater than omega... greater than or equal to omega 2.
Okay, now...
You have a pathology when you put your regulator mass on m equal to zero.
And that's going to be that's when this theory takes off. For the moment, everything I've given you so far is just background. The real heart of the theory is what's going to happen when I let omega 1 go to omega 2. This operator is no longer going to exist. And the Hamiltonian, I'll give you the punchline, is going to become non-diagonalizable. And that's why I'm doing this now, to show you that we have a branch of physics which in the end cannot be connected to Hermitian. But first of all, by going through the initial calculation, I've shown you how I can connect to a Hermitian Hamiltonian, and all I've got for the moment, it's no big deal, it's Hermitian in disguise, and the big deal for the fourth order theory was that it fell into that category. Finally, you realize that from the norm is with this extra e to the minus q, but e to the q is related to c, and c squared is 1. So if I now go back to my original guess, I can make this writing, provided I have the psi's on the imaginary axis, and now the minus sign is the eigenvalue of c. Because c squared is 1, so there is some space with positive c and some space with negative c, but I am in a Hilbert space with a positive norm. So that's how that's how we resolve the issue of how do you make sense of that particular propagator. Yes. So the answer is, it's very surprising, you wouldn't think it, but it's realized in a Hilbert space where the momentum and the position operators are not Hermitian.
Is this related to fermions at all?
No.
The Dirac C and all that stuff?
No. This is simply fourth order. If you were to write, well, for fermions, we have a first order equation. But if you wrote a second order equation for fermions, you'd run into this same problem. But it may have a slightly different solution because of the anti-symmetry can protect you in a way that it can't protect you here. So I have to get rid of the negative norms. Yes, sir?
I'm confused. So the previous slide, you should have this map. So what is the statement? Where is the relationship of?
Oh, what I said was that because the norm is not, because the norm of the theory, which I can write down.
Before you're saying that you have this exponential q. Right?
Yes, I had the sum on, this is the norm.
Yeah,
the sum on n e to the minus q is 1,
okay.
But that's the sum on n cp is 1. So when you put in the intermediate states in the quantum propagator, you pick up the eigenvalues of c. But c squared is 1.
Yes, I'm confused by something. Exponential of q is a positive. So all its eigenvalues are strictly positive. So
oh, yes, but so q is not c. Q, yeah. C is q.
The previous completeness relation, I think, is perfectly fine because you just have a metric which is positive.
Yes.
Well,
but there's a p here as well, and p does not commute with q.
No, but the completeness relation you wrote now.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so this completeness relation is fine.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But on the next slide, I would say it's not fine.
No, I said it was fine.
Yeah, okay, then there's a job.
No, I didn't make it. What I said was, because this operator appears in between.
Yeah, it's positive. It is a positive operator. That's the key point. There's no minus sign here. It could be plus 10 or minus 100, but one over 100, but it's a positive operator.
Yes.
On the next slide, you start to put a minus.
No. But the propagator has its matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. So I've got the e to the minus q, then the Hamiltonian, and then the other state, and I've got to go through.
But
the answer is.
I'm asking the question is, what is the relationship between this slide and the next one? You have a minus sign.
Where do you get the minus?
The minus is not part of the story you have told.
This minus comes about because the Hamiltonian is really left e to the iht right. And this itself is equal to right e to the minus q e to the iht right. And q and h don't commute.
Well, let's.
I understand your question. Let me just say, I've done the calculation.
So far, I think there's two statements in what you said. There's the statement which, if an Hamiltonian has only real eigenvalue, then there exists a similarity transformation, u minus 1,
yes,
to an Hermitian. think that's fine. Now, the next statement is that this similarity transformation might not be positive.
Yes.
And in the previous case, you had the example you wrote down, it was a positive similarity transformation.
Okay.
And I think that's physically still fine. Now, if you have a negative similarity transformation, you have a completeness relation which has minus sign in it.
No. This is, there's nothing wrong. Look, this is the completeness relationship in the rotated basis. And this is the completeness relationship in the unrotated basis. You will agree that in the rotated basis, this Hamiltonian, I'm going to have positivity of the propagator. Therefore, I must have positivity of the original, of the unrotated propagator. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying anything deeper. All I wanted to do was show you the Hilbert space. But okay, let me proceed, because I'm now one-third the way through the talk.
Okay, yes. The thing is that the state which has non-zero here is the zero state, whereas the state which has non-zero on the next leg is not necessarily zero.
Okay, let's proceed. Now, let me explain to you very quickly what's the relationship between non-hermeticity and unitarity. Suppose you take the Schrödinger equation for the Hamiltonian, you take the conjugate, and then you integrate, and you get e to the ih t to the minus ih dagger t. Then the norm of this state is plus h dagger minus h, is not time independent, and you will see written in the literature that theories with non-Hermitian Hamiltonians are not unitary. That's wrong. That just says that the Dirac norm is not preserved in time. So how do we figure out what is the correct norm? We apply, take a matrix element, put in the operators, and construct a Heisenberg field, starting from here, e to the ih dagger, as e to the minus iht, calculate its time derivative, and you get ahh minus h dagger ah. Now, that is what you would get by going from the Schrödinger picture to the Heisenberg picture in the usual way for a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. But this relationship is simply not true, because the Hamiltonian is always the generator of time translations. So it's always the time derivative must be the commutator with the Hamiltonian. So this relationship cannot be the correct relationship. Therefore, what you have to do is realize that these could not have been the correct states. So you start from this relationship and work back, and you find that you have to have a right Hamiltonian eigenstate and a left eigenstate, and then you can integrate these up, and then you discover that the left-right norm is time-independent and the theory is unitary. The Hamiltonian and the Hamiltonian dagger can be related by a similarity transformation, and therefore the left eigenvector is the transform of the right of the bra of the right eigenvector. What it simply says is, if I have a real energy spectrum, the Hamiltonian and its H dagger have the same spectrum, therefore they must be related by a similarity transformation, and therefore the states must be related too, and therefore unitarity is always a statement about right-left and not a statement about right-right consciousness.
So, concerning your last statement?
Yes.
Is your statement the fact that the dagger can always be related to H by a positive?
No, I just said that if H and H dagger have the same energy spectrum, they can be related by a similarity.
So which means that it cannot always be related by exponential of Q.
I should just have written this as U,
yeah,
as you S, S to minus one. However, I had constructed it in this particular case. This particular example, it is what you're looking for. Okay. Now we go back, but what happens when we let omega 1 equal a negative? So we'll proceed, I'll try to go a little bit more quickly now. When we let omega 1 equal omega 2, we find that the two wave functions, the two first particle eigenstates, omega 1 and omega 2, collapse onto the same eigenstate. The energies become degenerate because omega 1 is equal to omega 2, but the wave functions become the same wave function. So unlike the case where you have degenerate wave states with orthogonal wave functions, the two wave functions become a single wave function. Now, the two one-particle states have collapsed onto a one-particle, onto one state. To see what's going on is this. we can take omega 1 as omega plus epsilon, omega 2 as omega minus epsilon. This is the Hamiltonian, and these are the two eigenstates. And you notice that when epsilon becomes 0, the two eigenstates become the same wave function, which is the unusual feature. The similarity transfer, now Laurent will be very happy, I'll just introduce an S and an S to minus 1. The operator that diagonalizes this Hamiltonian into its eigenvalues is given by this form. You can construct it explicitly. And when epsilon goes to 0, you see that this blows up. So the similarity transformation stops existing. And when epsilon goes to 0, this Hamiltonian becomes 2 omega 1101. If you look at the 1101, it's got two eigenvalues, both equal to 1. You construct the eigenvector, and you find that C plus D has to be equal to CD, and therefore D has to be 0, and therefore there's only one eigenvector. So an eigenvector has disappeared. How can that be? Well, there's a theorem of Jordan which says the following, that if you take any matrix whatsoever, by a sequence of similarity transformations, you can either make it diagonal or have it such that on one side of the diagonal, everybody is 0. That's called the Jordan block form. Jordan block Hamiltonians cannot be diagonalized because the basis vectors are not complete. You're missing an eigenstate. You're not missing an eigenvector because an n by n matrix, the determinant of the matrix is 0, has n solutions. That can't change. But you're missing eigenstates. Now, when you miss eigenstates, these are called Jordan block. Now, one of the nice things about Jordan block Hamiltonians is that the 1 multiplies the 0 in the determinant, and therefore, it doesn't matter what you write here, it doesn't participate in the determinant, and therefore all the eigenvalues are diagonal. So Jordan's theorem is, you can always put the eigenvalues on the diagonal, and there is no reason for them not to be real. What is the problem is you may lose an eigenstate. And we do lose an eigenstate, and when we lose that eigenstate, we can no longer get over to the Hermitian theory. Therefore, this theory now lives on its own. Now, but now you want to know, where on earth did the eigenstate become? Well, if the answer is, if you look at psi 2 minus psi 1, over 2 epsilon and take the limit epsilon goes to 0, you get the wave function x plus omega y I t plus y, and it, you can show, is an exact solution of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. So let me just explain to you what I've done. If I have e to the minus I omega 1 plus epsilon t, and e to the minus I omega 1 minus epsilon t, and I let epsilon go to 0, I'm just going to get one wave function. But if I take the coefficients to be singular, going like 1 over epsilon, then I can pick up a term that's linear in t. And that's exactly what happens. The second solution is linear in t. But the second solution, if it's linear in t, is not stationary. Therefore, it's not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. However, what do we have? We start out with two states, both of which are stationary. That's unimportant. They're both solutions to the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. They also happen to be solutions to the time-independent, but they are solutions to the time-dependent. And when you take the limit, they remain solutions to the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, but one of them is no longer stationary. But the set of solutions to the time-dependent Schrödinger equation is complete. It's the set of solutions to the time-independent Schrödinger equation which is not complete. But it never needed to be complete. It's just that we are used to working with diagonalizable Hamiltonians, so it always has been complete. But it doesn't matter whether or not the Hamiltonian has a complete spectrum. All that matters is that the time-dependent Schrödinger equation have a complete spectrum. And now you notice that if we look here, one wave function is x plus omega y, and the second wave function is x plus omega y plus y. So the two wave functions have two degrees of freedom, one for x and one for y. The next excited state has x, y, x squared and y squared and so on. And you know that the two-dimensional harmonic oscillator solutions are in one-to-one correspondence with polynomials. Therefore, if I want to construct an arbitrary wave packet at an initial time, I have exactly the right number of wave functions to do it. Therefore, they're complete. I can construct a packet. Now I let the packet evolve. Because it obeys the Schrödinger equation, and because the surface term vanishes, because I'm on the imaginary axis, the norm is preserved in time, and therefore the theory remains unitary. So when a Hamiltonian is not diagonalizable, you may be missing energy eigenstates, but you don't lose unitary time evolution, because unitary time evolution is a property of the time dependence of the norm, not of the states. The Dirac norm, you would be dead. The Dirac norm is not going to be preserved in time. The Dirac norm you can't even define if you don't have enough energy eigenstates. But you still have a complete theory. What's going on is this. When you quantize a theory, you quantize x with p. You don't quantize h. You quantize x with p. You then get the quantization of h for free. It's not an additional requirement. Quantizing x with p gives you the Hilbert space, the complete basis of momentum states or of position states. That's your choice. Nothing requires the Hamiltonian to be in the full space. It can project out a piece of the space. The space, the Fock space of the x's and the p's is complete. The Hamiltonian may sit along a slice of it, but nothing says it has to. Nothing says that the eigenspectrum of the Hamiltonian has to be the same as the eigenspectrum of x and p. That's just what we've been used to since 1926. But it's not a theorem. And this is a counterexample. And therefore, non-diagonalizable Hamiltonians only see a sector of the Hilbert space. But it doesn't matter. You use the full Hilbert space, all the polynomials, to construct a wave packet, and then the evolution of the wave packet is unitary in time, and the theory remains unitary. And so this sector of the theory, when omega 1 is equal to omega 2, is a PT symmetric theory with real eigenvalues, with an incomplete eigenspectrum, which cannot be mapped into a Dirac condition theory. It's a whole new branch of quantum mechanics, and it is just as unitary in its time evolution as regular quantum mechanics. Now,
the question: what is the reality condition of the operator x? So, using
the x and y here are the eigenstates of those Hermitian operators that I just constructed here.
X and y are all.
These are real. These are the. Remember, I took the.
I'm not asking the x. I'm asking the operator x and the operator y is your new scala problem.
Yes.
What is x dagger and y dagger?
Okay. No. What's happening is this. I started out with PZ and Z. I made a similarity transformation to Y and Q, where those were now Hermitian operators because Z and PZ were anti-Hermitian. Q is Hermitian. Y is Hermitian. It has real eigenvalues. These are the eigenvalues. The coordinates are the eigenvalues of the operators. If the operators are Hermitian, the coordinates are real. And that's all I've done. Now, so that's how the theory works. Now, I must point out to you that Berkowitz and Ed Witten published...
Before you do this, the previous slide, is there a class, once you've got your font there that you like, is there a classical limit to it?
Is there what?
Is there a classical limit to the one that
you like? If you want to do a classical limit, you have to do it on the imaginary axis, yes.
So what do you mean by that? Do you mean that x has to be...
No. There is a classical limit for this theory with real x and y. It's totally unrelated to the original coordinates.
What does it have to do with the original theory? And the original theory is the original theory is that MP are real. Then you say let's make them anti-Hermitian, so that corresponds classically to making them imaginary, right?
Yes.
So but that's a different theory, right? It seems to me you're solving the problem for a different theory.
No,
not the theory
okay.
You started
what I'm setting out to do is show that that Hamiltonian with the pz squared and the pzx has a realization in which the norm is positive and the energies are bounded. I'm not curing. In fact, it's unimportant to me whether or not it has a classical norm. All I need to have is a theory which is well-defined quantum mechanical theory.
Yeah, but we are interested in the classical limit. Right?
Okay, let me try to answer you. The classical limit for that theory would be based on complex coordinates. But for the field theory, the x and y become the operators. They're no longer the coordinates. The x and y are now the dynamical degrees of freedom. That's the phi and the pi. They can be pure, they can be anti-Hermitian, but they can be functions of real coordinates. So what will happen in the quantum theory is we'll have phi of x and t and pi of x and t, and phi pi will be equal to I times delta 3 of x. But phi and pi will both be anti-Hermitian, but the coordinates will be real. So what's called the coordinates in the field in the quantum mechanics becomes the operators in the field theory, and then all you needed to know for this theory was that the time is real, because time is treated differently in quantum mechanics than space. But when you go to field theory, time and space are treated the same way. So the spatial coordinates, the parameters that define the space, are real, because they're Lorentz related to the time. The operators, the x and the y operators, become the field operators, the phi and the pi, and so the phi and the pi become anti-Hermitian.
So does it mean you make parts of the metric imaginary?
No, because this goes to I, and that goes to minus I, and the commutator is preserved.
The metric field that you want to find.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So what this is saying is, you're absolutely correct. What this is saying is that the way you make sense of gravity is by having g mu nu be anti-Hermitian. Now you would say, well, I can't do that because I know real gravity, but you don't. Because when you take the Riemann tensor, you get g up and g down, g up and g lower. And if you want to define, you replace g by ig, nothing changes. And in the S squared is g mu nu dx mu dx nu, the shortest distance between the two points doesn't change if you put an I here. The Christoffel symbol, gamma, is dg upper, is g upper dg lower. And the Christoffel symbol is invariant. So if you were to very perversely write classical gravity with a pure imaginary g, you would get exactly the same geodesics as you always get. Now, however, this is very interesting because this leads to a very interesting phenomenon which we haven't worked through. Could there be an interference effect between gravity and electromagnetism that would be different if the gravitational field is Hermitian or anti-Hermitian?
I didn't understand the distances. So where are distances that your distances are?
The shortest distance between two points is the minimum of the S squared. Well, it's also the minimum of constant times the S. No, the geodesic is the shortest distance between two points.
I ask a different question.
Oh, okay, then I will tell you to use IDS squared as your distance element. I don't mind. It's invariant.
But is there a picture which will describe the solar system together?
Yes. The solar system only depends on the geodesics and the background gravitational field. Doesn't need anything else.
If you want to do this gravity theory, strictly speaking, you have to introduce them. Non-Hermitian G mu nu.
That's what I just said, yes.
Yeah, that was the first modified gravity theory I ever published.
Ah, okay, John is already working through.
Mm-hmm. I published this in 1957.
Yes. Let me make a statement. The statement is, if you want the gravitational field to be purely Hermitian or purely anti-Hermitian, you can only tell the difference in an interference experiment.
So, in pure gravity, this is it's very interesting to know.
Yes.
So there is a matter field.
Yes.
I mean, if it's electromagnetism, it's okay. Because it's going to be, but if it's a fermionic or a scalar field,
yes.
I guess you.
No. That's a redefinition of the coupling constant. It's okay. That's just, you've just read. what you used to call alpha, you now call I alpha. And nothing changes unless there's an interference. Now, by the way.
But now you mess up the notion of energy and the other.
So I don't mess anything up. All I do is I have a T mu nil, and I predict motion.
I'm just saying that.
Okay. Anyway, let's
if you have matter, you can just change I. If you don't have matter, it's fine. If you have matter, you need to change I with.
No, I just you call G nu, and I call I G nu.
Well, it depends which type of matter.
No, but you.
Let me just try to state this. Look, we all are agreed that classical gravity has symplectic symmetry. Therefore, you can transform G into IG in classical gravity, and it's a perfectly consistent theory. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying this. I'm saying I'm just carrying that over to quantum mechanics.
If you do this in gravity, okay, so classically it's fine, and quantum mechanically we don't know.
Yes.
So let's see. This one, in fact, does it even affect whether there's an I or does it produce an I in the Einstein-Hilbert action?
It would have done if you had done the Einstein-Hilbert action this way, but then you redefine G.
Okay, but if you then introduce I's in the other field,
yes.
Wouldn't you get problems with the fact integrals?
Let me just tell you that I don't have time to discuss this. The path integral for this theory only exists if you introduce the I. It doesn't even the path integral forces you into that set of paths, and I'll show you why. You see, why was the original theory unbound to begin with? The original theory was unbound to begin with because of this minus z squared, and that's negative in the Hamiltonian, and you can just go indefinitely. If z is replaced by I z, this becomes boundary. Now, if because of that unboundedness, if you write a path integral and you go to deep Euclidean time, you must pick up tau e to the tau times the lowest energy. But the lowest energy is minus infinity, therefore the path integral doesn't exist. In order to make the path integral exist and regulate it so that you can get it to exist, you have to make z pure imaginary. So the path integral is forcing you into that choice, and the same thing will happen with the fields. These are very nice questions. Now let me try to get to the couple others.
Just one last different spirit.
Yes.
A lot of the talk about the quantum level, and it's very interesting, but in the original gravity case, the objections could have come in pure classically, that the question in the context of stability, right? In the classical, like Dr. Gradsky system, if I perturb a particular geometry, I have Bernoulli modes, and I can think of the classical level.
Okay.
And do you exclude those in this?
No, let me try to answer you. The thing that I don't have time to discuss, but the really remarkable thing, remember I showed you that we lost an eigenmode? What we lost was the runaway. It's okay. The limit theory turned, first of all, before I take the limit, I've shown you that there is a Hilbert space in which everything's stable. There are no negative norm states, and it's just a rotated Hermitian. But when you go to the limit, what happens is you lose eigenstates, and you lose the eigenstates that would have given you some problems in the class, because you're in the rotated class.
There's one critical thing about the
Let me try
one critical thing that's being left out here.
Yes. Okay.
In 1969, T.T. Lee and Giancarlo Wick published a paper.
Yes.
And they claimed to make quantum field theory finite.
Yes.
And they introduced exactly the propagator you started.
Yes, but they didn't use the Hilbert space that I used.
No, but just a minute.
They did.
In 1971.
Yes.
Two things happened. A paper was published by Kosky, Ockinghorn, and
Lanshoff. Okay.
And they pointed out that this theory, Lee and Wick put the unphysical pole, which is lack of unitarity, into the second image field. Effectively doing what you
No, did. This is completely different. The theory is unitary. I don't have to push the poles anywhere.
The claim was that it was unitary, but what this is called Nakanishi proof in 1971, the theory is not Lorentz invariant. So either you have unit charges.
No, you don't. You're looking at the you're applying the theorem to one theory, which is not a generic theorem of nature. If you're trying to tell me that this theory is not Lorentz invariant, then I don't know what to tell you. What is wrong with this theory? No, it's just a sum of oscillators.
This is
has nothing to do with Leeuwenhoek. And it doesn't have the problems of Leeuwenhoek. It's a different Hilbert space. It's not the propagator does not define the Hilbert space. You can't look at the propagator, which is a C number, and tell me I know the Hilbert space. That's what they tried to do, and then they pushed the states off into the second Riemann sheet. I'm telling you that they got the wrong Hilbert space. Okay, now, let me just make a comment to everybody here. A paper appeared by Berkowitz and Whitney a little time ago, in which they worked on something called conformal supergravity, which is a supergravity extension of conformal gravity, and they did it from the point of perspective of twisted string theory, and they came up with this 2x2 matrix for the Hamiltonian. And they said, this matrix is not diagonalizable, and that is correct, it's not diagonalizable. And they then went on to say, this clashes with our usual experience, that's also true. We are accustomed to the idea that translation generators are Hermitian operators and so can be diagonalized, that's true. However, conformal supergravity is not a unitary theory. Not true. And therefore, one symptom of it is this, that the translation generators are undiagonalized. Again, not true. So those two statements are simply not correct.
What? If you make an even number of incorrect statements,
yes.
Sometimes you can get to the correct.
Okay, anyway.
That's meant to be a joke.
Okay, Bender and I say not so fast. Okay, now, if you'll allow me a few more minutes. Okay, I wanted to tell you what's so special about fourth order theories. What's so special about fourth order theories is you can prove a Lehmann representation which tells you that the matrix element of the interacting two-point function is given as a spectral function over the free second order theory, and the free second order propagator appears because of the mass shell condition. Now, the argument which I thought was due to Smolin, but I asked him yesterday, and he said that it was even preceding him, it may be due to Stanley Dazer and Kerry Stella, is that since this behaves like 1 over k squared, and this behaves like 1 over k to the 4 in a higher derivative theory, rho cannot be positive, you need a cancellation. And rho cannot be positive violates the positivity of the Lehmann representation of the Lehmann spectral weight. But the Lehmann spectral weight's positivity came about because you assumed that the completeness relation was the conventional one. And so people have thought that this makes the theory non-unitary, it must be the sum on Nn minus the sum on Mn is the way you get the cancellation, but the answer is no, it's simply that it should be right left equals one, and these theories are not don't have a Hermitian Hamiltonian. But what this is telling you, now I've turned it around, what it's saying is, that if you have any theory which is higher derivative than second order, then you are forced into the non-Hermitian case. You're forced into the PT symmetric case. You cannot be in the Dirac null condition. So the solution to the problem is higher derivative theories automatically will throw you into this PT symmetric state. And you must give up the notion that the left eigenvector is the Dirac conjugate of the right eigenvector. And that's the solution, not the Leeuwenhoek solution or anything else. And that's why it occurred for us in the fourth order theory. And that, of course, answers a question. Why did we never encounter this before? Because we've always worked with second order theories, where it's the one case where rho can be positive and there is no contribution. However, if you write, Bender has done this, if you were to construct the spectral weight for p squared plus ix cubed, it would have exactly the same property. It would have alternating positive and negatives. Okay, now, if my hosts are up to doing this, I want to make a couple of remarks about zero-point energy in the cosmological constant problem. If you're with me so far, then you will accept that the primary argument against high derivative gravity being of a consistent quantum theory, the unitarity problem has been resolved. And if the theory is real,
for pure Biot, not for Biot plus Einstein.
Well, actually, for both. I mean, my proof was for both because
with your argument that the runaway Boltzmann wave was when the
No. But with the n squared, there's no runaway. It's e to the I omega 1 t, e to the I omega 2 t. Second plus fourth doesn't have a runaway. It has a complete. Is it everybody's notion?
But if the classical problem you originally worked down, I didn't go to the imaginary metric.
Yes.
Would have been more runaway, right?
No runaway.
The
runaway is only when you let m squared go to zero.
Okay, so what are you saying here?
So both second plus fourth and pure fourth are both, I hope you're accepting with me that both of them are unitary. And if so, we can do a consistent quantum theory. And so for the first time, we can now calculate the 0 point fluctuations. Now, the 0 point energy is a very strange object. People will tell you that the zero-point energy is the same thing as the cosmological constant. And I want to convince you, first of all, that that's not the case. Zero-point energy, if you just take a free fermion field, and you expand it in terms of d's and d-dackers, you calculate the vacuum expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, and in the end, it boils down to the matrix element of d-d-dagger. But d d dagger you can write as d d dagger plus d dagger d, because d and I makes the vacuum, and then you're left with a delta function, and that gives you the 0 point energy. So this is the 0 point fluctuation energy of a free massless fermion field. Now, that is not in the form of a cosmological constant, it's in the form of a perfect fluid. Why? Because if you evaluate this p nu p nu in a state propagating on the light cone, you get that value, it's not diagonal. Then you take minus p, and then when you add them up, you get the piece which is diagonal. Then you take modes propagating in the x and the y directions, and you add them up, and you get a normal perfect field. Rho and 3p, and you notice that rho is equal to 3p. Now, the cosmological constant has rho equals minus p. So if we write p mu nu is equal to rho plus p u mu u nu plus p g mu nu, then a cosmological constant is the same as rho is equal to minus p, but the trace here is 3p minus rho, and now the trace is zero if the particles are massless, because all I had a moment ago was p mu p nu. One second. All I had initially was p mu p nu, and if you take the trace and the particles are massless, then the trace is zero, which means that rho is 3p. Therefore, the 0 point energy is not the same, does not transform the same way as a cosmological constant. It's a different source of energy. The 0 point energy is the fluctuations around here. That's the 0 point energy. And this is the cosmological constant, is the change in the vacuum, and then you get a new 0 point energy when you fluctuate around there. So 0 point energy is the fluctuation around the vacuum. Cosmological constant is fixing where the vacuum is, and you can see immediately that this cannot be the 0 point energy, because it's traceless if the particle is massless, it cannot be the cosmological constant. So now we discover something surprising, and that is that the cosmological constant and the 0 point energy are different. And that will allow us to let each one cancel the other. And the way to see it is to just look at a four Fermi theory. I'm going to do it in two dimensions, because in two dimensions, the four Fermi theory is renormalizable. The coupling constant is dimensionless. I have the usual fermion wave equation. The fermion is massless. The energy momentum tensor is traceless. Now we are on a simio in two dimensions. I introduce a mean field. Take the matrix element of psi bar psi, I define it to be equal to m over g. I require that the residual interactions be zero, that's the usual Hartree-Fock. And now the fermion obeys a wave function with a mass. coming from this term, calculate the energy momentum tensor, and the energy momentum tensor is just matrix element of S minus matrix element of that term. The trace is still zero. So I've introduced an energy momentum tensor, and I've now got a mass, and I still have a traceless energy momentum tensor. I now expand the field in terms of the self-consistent mass, and I get the usual expansion. I calculate the matrix element of the kinetic energy in the state of no particles. I get P mu P nu. It's non-zero because B B dagger plus B dagger B is a delta function. That's the zero point energy. And then lo and behold, if I evaluate that, I show you it's the usual perfect fluid. But the m squared over g, the self-consistent piece, is related back to the matrix elements of the same field operators in the same state. So I can calculate it. And then when I do that, I find that m squared over g, which is commonly called the cosmological constant, is that. Therefore, the full energy momentum tensor is the zero-point fluctuations plus the cosmological constant. The trace is zero, and therefore the cosmological constant is equal and opposite to the zero-point energy. They are both produced by the mean field, and they cancel each other identically. What's going on? What's the problem of the cosmological constant? We usually say in cosmology, we have the positive energy fermions and the positive energy photons, and we have the cosmological constant, and that came from vacuum breaking. And we have no connection between them, and if there's no connection between them, you can't solve the problem. But if the cosmological constant is dynamically induced, it depends on the self-consistent state. But the zero-point energy is determined in the same state. And since the trace is zero, which it is in the conformal theory but not in the standard theory, they are obliged to cancel. So the answer to the question is, where did the zero-point energy go? It went in the cosmological constant. Now, the cancellation is not complete. And when what we measure observationally in cosmology is not the full lambda, but the amount of it which is not cancelled by the zero-point energy. And that's a small number. So the physical idea here is, once you have a renormalizable consistent quantum theory, you can now start talking about zero-point energy, you can renormalize it in the usual way, and you don't have to throw it out, which is how we do it in flat space. Gravity couples to energy, so it couples to zero-point energy. But then you discover that you induce a zero-point energy when you make the shift in the vacuum, and that cancels the cosmological constant, which is caused by the same shift, because the lambda and the psi bar psi are calculated in the same self-consistent state, and therefore you have control of the cosmological constant. So that's the mechanism. Dynamical symmetry breaking can solve the cosmological constant, because the constant then is not a constant. It depends on whichever states are occupied. It could be just the negative energy C, or in cosmology, it also includes the positive energy fermions, the 10 to the 80 fermions and the 10 to the 90 photons. But don't worry, the kinetic energy is the same story because it's in the same states. And the trace is always good, so the cancellation is always good. So what you discover is that conformal gravity has an opportunity to solve the cosmological constant problem, has an opportunity to solve the quantum gravity problem, and that in uncovering this, we had to go to something quite surprising, namely physics with non-diagonalizable Hamiltonians. And that discussion of the unitarity of non-diagonalizable physics could remain true even if conformal gravity turned out to be incorrect. So at least I hope you can take something away from this talk, and I thank you for your many questions and for your much patience.
We had lots of questions, so that's great.
Let's look at the last sentence before you turn it off.
If the Higgs is a C number condensate, there will not be produced in an accelerator such as the LHC. Yes. That is correct. So if the Higgs is dynamical, the whole Higgs search becomes totally different, and the Higgs would then become a collective excitation of the kind that Brauch and Ongler bequeathed to us 40 years ago. Yes, sir.
Just field theory, no gravity.
Okay.
Suppose I have one of these theories, ideal relativity.
Yes.